Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
I want to start off by reading you something. I got a letter about 3 weeks ago from a lady in Paris who said, there's a little poem at the back of The Artist's Way that really contains the entire book. And I was delighted to hear that because in my secret life, I'm a poet and have been since I was a little kid. And I also thought, couldn't she have said that before I wrote the rest of it? This is the High Self-Worth Poetry Book, all organized now. This was a poem that was written before this book was written. And it was written because I had a friend in Chicago whose name is Eli. And Eli was a very interesting man to me. He was, for one thing, very beautiful. He was wizened and gypsy-like and had very alert, darting brown eyes and sort of gnarled hands. And he would sit very quietly. And then when he would talk, he was mesmerizing. And he grew up on the south side of Chicago, which is not too much known for being mesmerizing. It's sort of bud country. At any rate, Eli gravitated toward me, and I toward him, and from my side, it was real clear that he was a writer. I think that one of the things that I have been lucky enough to be gifted with is being able to play Name That Animal when it comes to creativity. A lot of times I will have a very good hunch at what someone is good at when I meet them. It's just a little intuitive thing. Eli, meanwhile, never thought he could be a writer. And the reason that he didn't think he could be a writer was because he grew up in a family and a family system that might be familiar to some of you. It's the kind of family where if you were to say something like, I'm going to be a writer, what they would say is, you? Or, who would read what you're interested in, Eli? Or, that's very nice, dear, but don't you think you should find something sensible? Have you considered the odds? I don't think it's going to pay the rent. So Eli had a lot of that kind of damage going in. And this was a poem for Eli. It's called Words for It. I wish I could take language and fold it like cool, moist rags. I would lay words on your forehead. I would wrap words on your wrists. They're there, my words would say, or something better. I would ask them to murmur hush and shh, shh, it's all right. I would ask them to hold you all night. I wish I could take language and daub and soothe and cool, where fever blisters and burns, where fever turns yourself against you. I wish I could take language and heal the words that were the wounds you have no names for. So that was the impulse behind writing the Artist's Way book. I had been a writer since I was a little kid. I grew up in a big yellow house out in the country with seven siblings, or there are seven including myself. And it was a situation that some of you may find familiar, which is that when one kid comes along and is pretty good at the piano, when the second kid comes along, the piano's taken. Do any of you have an officially creative sibling? Well, then you grew up with a very intimate version of something that I call being a shadow artist. Shadow artist is a phrase that I invented to explain the fact that very often people who are extremely gifted will put themselves in the proximity of other people who are officially more gifted. And I want to be clear that they are only officially more gifted. Very often a shadow artist is the person who does the work at the office. I mean, you can feel free to just groan or weep if this strikes any chords with you. But a shadow artist is someone who maybe dates a person or marries a person who is pursuing the desired art form. I don't know if any of you know men who complain bitterly about their bad luck with actress after actress. And you say, well, why don't you stop dating actresses? And what we really need to be saying is, why don't you take an acting class? But we don't always get that. So in any case, many of us grew up in homes where art was something around the edges. Creativity was very nice, but not necessarily something that someone from my background might aspire to. I grew up in Libertyville, Illinois. We had one movie theater. It played Walt Disney movies. You had to sneak over to Lake Forest to see B movies. Growing up in Libertyville, the first shot out of the box was not, hey, I think I'll be a filmmaker. And I'm 45 years old, and when I was growing up, the first shot out of the box, if it had even approached filmmaking, would have been, maybe I could marry one or date one. So there's a lot of undoing to be done for many of us as we begin to move toward dreams that we have been probably fairly systematically ignoring, distancing, grimly admitting, beating ourselves up about. But no matter which way you cut it, the fact remains that many of us have dreams and we have difficulty actualizing these dreams, and we have a lot of things that we say to ourselves about these dreams. We say things like, well, if I had $1 million, I'd write the book. Or, you know, if I just had a little bit more time, if I had a year off just to paint, I would paint. And I think that having a vast savanna of time and finding yourself unable to move toward the easel or the page or the stage is very, very painful. So I want to tell you a little bit about pain, because that is how I came to write this book. I have been a writer since I was a little kid. My early writing was at the Washington Post, and I was actually a very snooty East Coast writer for a little while. And then I walked onto my first movie set, and it was like, oh, I see. They didn't tell me about this in Libertyville. And I became a screenwriter and eventually a director. And during the course of all of this, did a lot of journalism, a lot of work for studios, a lot of independent work, and work in the theater, and just many, many, many forms of creativity, which may sound like, what would this woman know about being blocked? Clearly, she has never had a block in her life. I would propose that what I am telling you is the story of someone who was so damaged whenever she was banged up in area A, she would jump off of that particular skillet onto frying pan B and tap dance there, and then when that would become frustrating, I would leap into yet another pan. And what I began to learn was, how do you stay functional and creative? Because what they do not tell us when we start out to be creative beings, when we have these dreams, I mean, none of us at 7 years old think, I'm really going to screw up my parents. I'm going to grow up to be a writer. On the other hand, very often, if you tell your parents or a teacher who has set aside that dream, and you tell them that you're actually going to go ahead toward it, very often you get immediately WB'd. Do we all know that WB means wet blanket? In other words, as we propose something like, I have the greatest idea for a new screenplay. It is so cool. One of our poisonous pals will say, do you know what the odds are of selling an original screenplay? The minute you hear, do you know what the odds are? You need to know that that person does not want you to engage in that piece of creativity. Very often, when we are stymied about pursuing certain dreams, we are surrounded by other people who are equally stymied, and there's a sort of group consciousness about just how creative we are all going to be. And it manifests some real interesting tremors when someone starts breaking the rules. So let's say there are four of you and you've been working at this place for 12 years. You all hate it. And then suddenly Tim starts saying, so I'm going to Europe. And people start saying, you think you're going to have a job when you get back? You know, what they should be saying is, maybe we can get a group rate. But the point that I am trying to make is that often we come into the world with a dream, we broach it to the family, and the family says, you'll never earn a living doing that. You better find something sensible. People from our background, don't you know that in order to be successful as an artist, you have to be well connected? You have to know Arnold Schwarzenegger real well. And you're sitting there thinking, I can't believe my father just brought up Arnold Schwarzenegger in a conversation about art. But one way or another, you get wet blanketed. Those of us that don't get wet blanketed that way may have a different kind of block, which is being raised by parents who say things like, you can be anything you want. You are so gifted. Does this sound familiar to anybody? I want to talk a little bit about what that does, because when parents say to you, you are so gifted and so marvelous and you could do anything, they don't say, but it will be very difficult for you to do it as for anyone else. So what happens is that when that child encounters difficulty, they think either my parents lied to me or I fooled my parents. It creates an incredible sense of guilt. They don't understand why, if it's supposed to be so easy for them, it's so difficult. They get a really highly developed imposter syndrome. Do you know what I'm talking about here? Is this making sense? What I'm sort of tiptoeing toward is talking about the ideas that we have in our culture about what it means to be a creative person, what it means to be an artist. And one of the ideas that we have is that there's such a thing as this tiny little cluster of insiders, and they all know each other, and if you don't know them, don't bother to apply. And a real artist is somebody who doesn't have any doubt, right? They are born knowing that they are an artist. Their parents can say to them whatever they choose, but these people will kill, right? before they will let anyone interfere with their artistic trajectory. Does this sound familiar? They also usually wear black. See, I believe that in America, we have a very skew notion of what it is to be creative. I actually blame it on the assembly line. One of the things that is very crippling for creative people in our country is that if you are good at doing more than one thing, you get punished for it. You get called, either by yourself or by other people, you are such a dilettante. And the phrase, you are such a dilettante, is something that people use. Let's say that you draw pretty well, you paint pretty well, and you write pretty well. What the knife edge of calling each other dilettantes does means that if you're thinking about sitting down and working on the novel a little, this little voice says, pardon me, you should be painting. If you move over toward the painting, the novel starts to get very hyperactive in the background, clears its throat and says, you haven't looked at me in 6 months. The net result of all of this is that people who are extremely creative are often taken out right at the knees because they believe falsely that they need to commit to one vein of creativity. Just do one thing until you're good at it, all right? There is a belief system that artists are totally driven, that they are born knowing what it is they want to do, that nothing can deter them, that they all wear black and they have no fear. Okay? And the other thing I should add is whoever they aren't us. What you are dealing with here, you know, we have an enormous amount of shame that we have not already written these books, painted these paintings, done these sculptures, gotten our plays mounted. We take it in as if the reason nothing has come or too little has come or we quit is because we have a rotten character. What I would like you to see is that you are in an anti-art culture with an anti-creativity consciousness, that we have a belief system that says artists are lone wolves. There is nothing to support this. There is nothing to support this, but we believe that artists are loners. And yet, when you start thinking about the Fauves, for example, they all hung out together. The Impressionists had lunch. That's what they painted. Success occurs in clusters, and a great deal of what you are missing as a creative person has to do with having an adequate set of what I call believing mirrors. For most of us, it's a lot more like growing up in the funhouse. You take your dream of writing and you play it to your family, and it is reflected back to you as a monstrous, ego-driven, misshapen, crazy thing. Here's this innocent little kid. You know, you didn't come out of the womb thinking, I'm going to wreck their lives. I'm never going to make more than $40,000, right? Their grandchildren won't have any of the advantages that they would wish. I'm going to be an artist. No, it comes from a very pure place. And then it becomes distorted by our culture. So, how many people think that artists are broke? Not more than 70% of us, right? Okay, so I want you to take a look at what this does. If your belief system is artists are broke, what happens if you're pretty good with money? Then you're not an artist, right? You know, you don't say to yourself, gee, I'm pretty good with money, but then so was T.S. Eliot. He worked in a bank. you say, what are you kidding about writing this novel? You're an accountant. And the way that this works is that if you believe that in order to be an artist, you have to be willing to be broke, then you are setting up a belief system that's either or. And one of the swell ways that we keep ourselves blocked is that we will figure out a price tag that strikes us as unpayable, and we will tell ourselves that that is the cost of being artistic. So if your particular terror is being poor, you'll decide that artists are broke, therefore it's much too terrifying to move into your creativity. How many people believe artists are crazy? Okay. This is, well, at least we're running a good, clean majority on some of the real negatives here. How many people believe that artists are really unhappy? Just generally pretty unhappy? How about unpleasant to be around? Tortured. I just want to say for the record that blocked artists are tortured. Functional artists are relatively cheerful people. And this is a very, very well-kept secret. But if you have ever been around a writer after they have done a couple of good paragraphs, they're in a fairly zippy mood. And if you have ever been on a movie set when they have done a particularly nice day's work, people are extremely pleased with themselves. And if you have ever been in a life drawing class the first time it worked, or gotten your first laugh in an improv class, this is cheery material. But in this country, we don't talk very much artist to artist. We don't talk about, yeah, when I was in the third grade, the art teacher told me that I shouldn't put pink next to green, so I didn't know that I could paint till I was 25. You know, we don't tell each other our stories around our creativity. And the stories that we get told around creativity are great artists as told to us by press agents. There was an excerpt in, I think, either Lear's or Mirabella's, I forget which, the story of a fella going to see Picasso. I'm going to just tell it a little because it's the position that all of us are in regards to art in our culture. We have a lot of confusion here of success with money and creativity with product. If you tell someone you're painting, they say, have you had a show? If you tell someone you're a playwright, they say, ever been produced? If you tell someone you're writing a screenplay, they ask if you have an agent. We are greatly enamored and culturally trained to be focused on the end result. And part of how that happens is that we don't really meet in clusters and tell each other the truth about what the process is actually like of doing some of these things. So this fellow decided he would get Picasso to sketch him. It was World War II. He faked a limp, and he limped up to the front of Picasso's house, and he knocked on the doors. They were massive wooden doors like Jurassic Park, you know, like knock, knock, Picasso. And Picasso did not come to the door. He had his mayor domo come to the door. And the guy said, I'm a crippled hero. I want him to draw me. And he said, well, the master's very busy and very important, and I shouldn't disturb him. But I'll go ask. He did not say, he's upstairs getting sick to his stomach because he's decided that Guernica is a bad painting. He did not say, oh, he's fighting with one of his girlfriends again, so he doesn't have to paint today. He's a relationship addict. He didn't say, he's having a bad day. Picasso was one of the first artists who really managed his press. So when we think about moving into our creativity, we don't think about... I got in a lot of trouble a few years ago. I was teaching film, and I said to the other faculty, let's show them all of our terrible movies. And they said, we can't do that. They wouldn't respect us. And they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't put their student films up for the kids to see. So I thought, well, so I got in touch with a bunch of famous directors and said, could we please see your terrible movies? So they sent me their terrible movies. So we were in a room about this size watching early George Lucas. I don't know if any of you have had the opportunity to do this, but it is like you're watching it and you're going, this man made Star Wars. What about accounting, George? You know, there is... when you look at beginning work with the most tender eyes, you can usually see the shoots of what may come later. But it is equally true that very gifted people sometimes don't do very gifted work. And that when we are beginning at something, we don't measure our baby step films, our first visions of ourselves on videotape, the poem that doesn't come around for us, the way we sound in our early singing lessons. How about what our first pots look like? We don't console ourselves by comparing those to the early failed pots of great potters. Or, gee, even George Lucas made a really bad student film, so there might be a future for me yet. Instead, we are up against this PR machine that there is such a thing as a tribe of real artists. They do great work, they have no doubt. Their work is extremely well received, and they are all tortured, and who wants to be that way? So I might as well not do any of it, thanks, let's go skiing. Do you hear some of how this thing starts to work? Okay. I'd like you to line up the jump that is the dream. Like, let's say it's a novel or painting or, in other words, name that dream. Put it in the sentence that goes, I, and then your name. I, Julia, am a brilliant and prolific writer. So please write the sentence five times and listen for the objections and note them. So what we're doing is we're, you know, like bad children doing that by rote sentence, the affirmative sentence, and we're listening for that ugly little blurt. So go. Do it five times as quickly as you can. The first time that I worked with this technique was about 15 years ago. And I wrote, I, Julia, am a brilliant and prolific writer. And the first blurt was, no man will ever love you. The second blurt was, then you're gay. The third blurt was, you'll always be alone. I'm looking at these three pieces of information and going, where did these come from? And it was pretty clear. They came, sorry, Mother, but they came from my mother, Dorothy, whose belief system was, it really wasn't feminine to be obsessed with something. no man would ever love you. If you weren't interested enough in that, then you probably were gay, and you would definitely be alone. What we are dealing with here is something that is sometimes called negative introjects, otherwise known as internalized negativity that is clustered and clumped around this stuff. And it isn't rational, and we don't know we have it, and it gets between you and your work. Did anybody come up with, and you know, normally it goes for your particular area of weakness, your sexual desirability, the fact that you have no original ideas. Could I hear a couple of blurts? Anybody want to just, all right, could I hear? Huh? You've got to be kidding. You don't have the talent. All right, I want you to listen to the tone of this. Because what we are encountering here is something that I call the censor. And the shorthand way to think of your censor is that it is the worst bully that you knew in grammar school, but much smarter. Its normal tone is sarcasm, which is from the Greek to cut or tear flesh. Its normal tone is sarcastic. So we had the blurt here. Who are you kidding? You don't have the talent. You know, can't you just picture this happening on the playground? Who are you kidding? You don't have the talent. Could I hear another one? Arrogant. Okay, one of the things that we believe is that it is our ego that wants us to create. One of the things that we are afraid of being told is, who do you think you are? Does this resonate for people? The truth is that it's our ego that wants us not to create. Our ego is concerned with keeping us safe and keeping us unexposed or having us only look terrific when we are exposed. The part of us that wants to create is much more naive, playful, and less driven by that harsh drive. So the first thing you were told is you were arrogant. I'd like to hear a couple more from you, if you don't mind.
I'm a technician more than an artist.
Okay, please listen to this. She's arrogant, she's a technician rather than an artist. If you work with your censor very long, you'll notice that every time you face down one thing, there'll be a new ground that it will attack on. For example, if you were trying to write your first play, it would be saying to you, what makes you think you're a playwright? Why do you think you can write a play? If you then had a very successful first play, your censor would come back to you with, well, you had one. This is why it's so difficult for people to write a second novel, because immediately the jumps are raised. And the part of you that raises the jumps, the part of you that indulges in emotional terrorism toward your creativity, is your censor. We all have this well installed. I usually ask people to make a cartoon of it. Sometimes people will just come in and say, this is my mother, this is my father. Other times, you know, they'll bring in the shark from Jaws. Could we hear some more blurts? Okay, you can't do that, you're too old. In other words, she's coming squarely up against another wonderful American belief. Artists are born, they have no doubt, and they are successful by the time they are 21, at least by the time they are 30. They're, you know, kind of to the athlete dying young. To tell you the truth, one of the things that's interesting about culture in America is looking at the fact that when we talk at least about writing, and actually this is often also true about painting, what passes for our aesthetic is actually the progression of alcoholism. And so when we say there are no second acts in American lives, what we leave out is because they were all too drunk to write them. A lot of our mythology around suffering artists is actually the progression of people's alcoholism. You know, we say things like, well, he was having a hard time with his art, and that's why he pulled the trigger. You know, we all know that it was the novel that loaded the shotgun. And we are dealing with something actually very interesting right now because of the proliferation of 12-step programs. We have, for the first time, got a generation of sort of, forgive me, born-again artists who are capable of going on. This is particularly fun to watch in rock and roll, you know, where people are able to go on and do their maturing as an artist. We watch this in Europe all the time. In Europe, when people talk about artists, they don't think they have to be babies. Some of the greatest filmmakers are still making films in their 60s, 70s, 80s, and they make a very different film as an older man with a sense of joy, lightness, spiritual nonchalance than they do as an angry 20-year-old. In America, where we think our artists have to be young, at the very point where people are coming into their vision, lots of times we think, that's a little too cheerful to be a real artistic vision. Don't make me laugh. That can't be great art. And so how that works is that it tells you, when you think about playing the piano, do you know how old I will be by the time I really learn to play the piano? Yeah, you're going to be the same age you'll be if you don't learn how to play the piano. But we don't talk about that. I'd like you to look just briefly at the fact that in our country, people can have fun until they're 18, maybe 20. Kids, let them explore. The other time that we're allowed to have fun is once we're past 60. Senior citizens, let them explore. Get them one of those nice caravan buses. Let them go to Yosemite. Meanwhile, what are we doing? You know, what we are doing between 20 and 40 is not fun. No, we're supposed to be earning a living. We're supposed to be becoming very important. We're supposed to be extremely serious here. So if you think about things that you want to do, you'll find that there's a whole lot of things that are fun to do that you're too old to do. That's what your sensor will immediately say. I'm sorry, you're too old to take a creative writing class. And then there'll be another set of things that it'll say, you're too young to do that. When you retire, then you can take up painting again. Could we hear a couple more blurts, please? Yes. Oh, thank you. Do not have enough self-discipline. Boy, I really love this. This is another one of those PR situations. When we read about artists talking through reporters who have their own ideas about artists, and therefore, and I know this, I've been a reporter for 25 years, therefore ask questions designed to get certain answers. You know, for example, if you say, you must have tremendous discipline, Mr. Lee, to make these films, he's probably going to say, well, yeah, I guess I do, or something like that. Discipline is a word that we use to beat ourselves up. We tell ourselves that artists are people who are born knowing that they are artists, they wear black, and they have discipline. What you're doing with that word, first of all, it's a disguised character attack. Again, you have no discipline, blah, 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 blah. What they're also not talking about is that it's fun to do something creative. Once you get used to doing it, it doesn't take discipline. Oops. Once you get used to doing it, it doesn't take discipline. It's fun. It's enjoyable. You feel better when you do it. I hate to say this, but probably the best way to think about your creativity or developing any creativity or unleashing any creativity or using any creativity is as if you had just decided that you were going to run a marathon. Because what we're really talking about is starting extremely slow, building very carefully. We're talking about watching out that you don't get shin splints, watching out for your creative injuries. It's much more like having a sports career than it is like anything else. And you don't hear athletes talking about their discipline. They say that they play games. Musicians at least have the language right. Do you ever notice how musicians look like they're having fun? They're going to go play a gig. The rest of us have this idea that it has no pain, no gain. Could we hear another word, please? Oh, daydreams a lot. This is another character attack. Instead of saying, terrific imagination sprouts off in all sorts of different directions, daydreams a lot translates, I think, as lacks focus. Staring out the window again, Mary Frances. You know? Would you please jot down the names of three creative monsters? Creative monsters are people who say things to you like, this is an awfully good essay, Terrence. Did you get some help with this? I'm going to give you some categories, and as I do, just jot a name down. This is just sort of a scanner here. Let's start with physical klutziness. Have you ever been shamed around physical klutziness? If so, write down the name or the incident. If you have been made to feel clumsy, even if it's, you know, you're picked last at baseball, what that does is make it very difficult for someone to have a career in the performing arts. So, first look at physical klutziness. Second, have you ever been shamed around your spatial abilities? This living room, Alice, your spatial abilities. Okay, if you have, it can make it real difficult for you to even think about doing anything around design, working in clay. Have you ever been shamed around your artistic abilities? I think that there must be a secret school, perhaps in Kansas, where they train high school art teachers. And you are only allowed to go there if you are extremely competitive with gifted students. How many of you have been shamed around acting? Shamed around acting often happens when you're 3 or 4 years old. Or actually, I guess it doesn't happen when you're 3 or 4. It happens when you're between 8 and 12. When you're 3 or 4, it's still darling if you're the ham. When you're 8 to 12, they're sending you to bed and asking you to not disrupt the dinner. When you get that kind of message, it's hard to undo it later. Have you ever been shamed around your writing? How many people here have been told that since they can't spell and they have terrible grammar, they can forget being a writer? First of all, I want to assure you that not being able to spell and having terrible grammar qualifies you to be a writer. For 7 years, I was married to a writer, and most of our marital conversations were screaming from the other end, "How do you spell? I don't know. Look it up." So you don't have to be able to spell. You don't have to have perfect grammar. However, you get told that in third grade, And that will come between you and your novel at age 63, unless you kind of get it up in the air and turn it around. Because your unconscious does not understand computers. It does not know spell check. All it knows is Sister Ann Rita told me I couldn't be a writer because I can't spell, so I can't be a writer. I want to say one other thing. I think the real reason that we're here is that you have probably all discovered that you cannot kill these dreams. And we have tried. And if you do not actualize these, they will not be dead when you are 80. You may be dead, but that unfulfilled part of you will still be alive. It will still be itching. So you might as well turn around and start to work with it. The reason I had you look at all of that is because although you may have a favored dream around your creativity, you will often find that there are secondary dreams that you also love, which have been nipped early. I also want to say to you that creativity and the recovery of creativity is a very trackable, doable process. The reason that my book is selling is because it works. It hasn't been advertised. It's had about 4 reviews, as far as I know. The reason that it works is because it's normal for us to be creative. What is abnormal, what is painful, is the layering of blocks that we have. The tools that are in the Artist's Way are very simple. I want to quickly explain the 2 major tools. The first tool is 3 pages of longhand morning writing. Yes, it has to be in the morning. And it also has to be longhand. I have tried to cheat for years. And when I do them on my word processor or on my computer, they do not get to the same level. The first page and a half is easy. The pay dirt is the second page and a half. That's why there are 3 pages. Once in a while, you do need to write more than 3 pages. However, I think 3 pages is pretty much generally the right amount. The reason that I think that is that it's a doable amount and that there is an amount that begins to look at new territory and to turn new dirt. And all growth is incremental and slow. This is actually a very fast process, and to put pedal to the metal and accelerate it still further may create a sense of shakiness that may be difficult for people to cope with. So 3 pages a day is a doable amount. Usually takes people an hour or 45 minutes when they start, and then they take 15 when you are used to them. What the morning pages will do is miniaturize your sensor. In other words, there is no wrong way to do them, and as you begin doing them, your sensor will say, these are terrible. They're so negative. You're such a spiritual midget. You whine. Boy, have you got terrible grammar. You can't stick on a single topic. They are meant to be negative sometimes. They are meant to be whiny, petty. The Jungians among us might say that this is one of the ways that we meet our shadow. I would say it's meeting your shadow and asking it out to dinner. Because what you are really doing is becoming much more friendly with those sides of you that you would prefer to ignore. Jealousy, pettiness. One of the ways that I talk about the morning pages is that it is a withdrawal process, but not in the way that you may think with a withdrawal from alcohol or drugs or sugar or caffeine. We've all given up a lot of things, and it's having the substance yanked from us. You know, we can't drink anymore. We can't do caffeine anymore. The withdrawal when you do your morning pages is the reverse. You are withdrawing your own energy that has been placed in other people's opinions, in other people's priorities, in other people's agendas, and other people's business generally, back into your own core, which doesn't mean that you will no longer care about people, but it means that you will be more selective in where you expend your energies. And that happens pretty quickly. By the third or fourth week, you will find that if someone has always shown up a half hour late and you've always said it was fine, they show up a half hour late and you say, "Don't do it again." And then you think, "Who said that?" There's a phrase in the book which says, "A leap and the net will appear." And most of us would take risks if we had guarantees. We would write the screenplay if we knew we were going to be up there thinking, do they like the dress? You know, when we make our Oscar speech. We would be willing to paint if we knew that we would get good shows, that the paintings would be bought. It is very difficult to move out on faith. That's why the whole structure of the course is doing tiny little things on faith, which brings me to the second major tool, which is the artist date. This is a very difficult tool because it is frivolous sounding. If we were doing this collectively as a class, you would all resent, hate, and become quickly addicted to, in a positive sense, your morning pages. We understand work. And you would begin to be interested in yourself and your own narrative through line and what you really feel. The artist date, which is about a 2-hour block of time once a week in which you simply take yourself and your consciousness out. You do not take children, spouses, significant others, nephews. You don't do it in clusters and groups. You do it all alone. It's solitude. Solitude of an interesting nature. So, if we were doing it as a 12-week course, you would have one couch potato VCR artist date allowed. Other than that, most of us move through our lives on certain pathways. We have a way that we drive to work. We have a few restaurants we go to. And the rest of it is terra incognita. There are things that pique our interest and we never let ourselves explore. 2 hours each week you need to explore. When you do your artist dates in conjunction with your morning pages, you begin to trigger an enormous amount of synchronicity. You will find, as you work with these tools, that you will increasingly have the question and have the answer come to hand. You will be in the right place at the right time. It gets a little scary. You know, you will think, "I'd love to make a film," and you will go to dinner and you'll be sitting next to someone who is teaching an adult filmmaking class. And it's sort of like, uh-oh, the jig is up. And I want to say to you that in the years that I have been teaching this, I have had people come to me. A lady came to me in Chicago at a night like this, and it was a situation where I was going to be able to teach for 12 weeks. I, by the way, wrote the book so that people could do this by themselves because it's very much an inside situation. And I want to address one thing, which is that typically when people learn, they assign the learning to the teacher. They don't say, "I'm great in history." They say, "Professor Wilkinson was really a great history professor." All right, the reason that I wrote The Artist's Way, the reason that all the exercises circle back on what do you think, how do you do it, how do you feel, is so that people would understand that it's all about their connecting to their creativity and that creativity connecting to a great interconnected sea of creativity. In other words, it completely blows that notion of insiders and outsiders. Only 4 people can get published. It's so crowded at the top. It is not crowded at the top. It is crowded at the bottom. So to circle back, it was a night like this, and a woman came up to me after I spoke and said, "Have you ever had anybody go crazy from doing this work?" And I looked at her, and she looked very rickety. And she said, "Really, have you ever had anybody go crazy?" And I thought, well, there is always a first time. But what I said was, no, people very often go sane. Going sane can feel a lot like going crazy. And what I want to suggest is, if you're going to work with this process, which is emotionally turbulent, if you do get shaky, I'd like you to be willing to seek some therapy. If you want to make that deal, I'll teach you. We made the deal. She said, "I'm 55 and I have always wanted to write." So she began writing the basic tool, which is morning writing. The third week of class, she brought in her first short story, and it was about incest. And clearly, she had, working with the morning pages, things had moved to the surface that she had intuited correctly were there. There was a reason she was afraid to write. What she did was keep working with the process, start working with a therapist, start working with a group around that. And for the next 3 years, it seemed like every time I would open my mailbox, I would have another little note which would say, "Dear Julia, just wanted you to know I won another playwriting contest." You know, and I used to say to Mark, you know, I'm sort of a spiritual midget, depending on whether my play or whatever I'm working on is, you know, did I write today? Then I'm in a wonderful mood. Did I not write? Then I don't feel quite as good about this little note, you know? I mean, one of the things that's a little strange for me is that, you know, I've spent 25 years writing, only to have this marvelous success over here about helping other people be creative. And people say it must feel really marvelous and to have this wonderful success. And I say, well, it's a little like being the Masters and Johnson of creativity. You know, what would you rather do, help people do it or get to do it? And
Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.